With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
In the dying embers of human existence, as the asteroid, a behemoth the size of Texas, hurtles relentlessly toward Earth, the world braces for an apocalyptic end. Deep beneath the bunker, a refuge plunges into the bowels of the Earth. Here the Chosen gather, their purpose clear, to preserve the very soul of our civilization. The 35 and 70 millimeter prints that encapsulate the magic, the emotion, and the dreams of generations past. These masterpieces, each frame a testament to the human spirit, are carefully catalogued and cradled in the cavernous confines of the bunker. Perhaps there was room for more. For friends and family yearning for salvation, but sacrifices must be made. The movie nerds stand united, the keepers of a flame, promising a future where the art of storytelling endures, transcending the boundaries of time and space. God help us all.
Welcome to Back to the Framerate, part of the Westin Media Podcast Network. Join us as we watch and discuss films on VOD and streaming platforms, deliberating on whether each one is worthy of salvation or destined for destruction in the face of the impending asteroid apocalypse. I'm Nathan Shore, and accompanying me are the extraordinary movie mavens Brianna Budworth and Sam Cole.
Woo! Hello.
Hello.
Hello. My question to both of you, to set up our episode: what sort of confectionery nightmare would result in a merger of Paul Marshall's chocolate empire and Willy Wonka's chocolate empire? And would you buy stock in that company? And why or why not?
Too many words. I don't understand. But sure, why not? I would take a financial risk and buy stock in the company, because why not?
Oh, man. No, I can't do it. I can't buy stock in the pervert chocolate, but I imagine there's marshmallows to answer your first question.
That should be the name of the new company, Pervert Chocolate.
Pervert Chocolate.
Yeah. It's already creepy enough with each company on their own, so I would beware. Buyer beware.
Yeah. Can't be long for this world.
All right, so obviously we are watching what we watch this week, Atonement from 2007 from director Joe Wright. You know, I want to ask you guys, first of all, is this the first time? This is not the first time any of us have watched this, right? This is not
no,
new to
sir.
Us. No,
hey,
we are.
I saw this in the theater back in around January 2008, actually. Yeah.
It's had to look great on the big screen.
It did.
Yeah.
It's visually impressive.
I missed this in the theater. I saw this probably the summer that it came out. This was a packed year at the theater. This when this came out. We're going to get to the movie facts in a moment, but I remember this was a lot happening in the theater in December 2007. Let me do the plot synopsis and a clip from the trailer, and we will get into it. I have, again, two plot synopses here because I'm having a good time with these here. But the plot synopsis: we follow the lives of young lovers Cecilia Tallis, played by Keira Knightley, and Robbie Turner, played by James McAvoy, when the couple are torn apart by a lie constructed by Cecilia's jealous younger sister, Bryony, played by Saoirse Ronan. All three of them must deal with the consequences. Robbie is the hardest hit since Bryony's deception results in his imprisonment, but hope for Cecily and her beau increases when their paths cross during World War II. I guess that's an okay plot synopsis, but
it's a little dry.
Yeah, but I have a better one here. And, you know, I sometimes occasionally like to plug in something into ChatGTP, and the parameters are, give me a plot synopsis that explains this for younger audiences, like if you were a six-year-old. And I like this. Imagine a little girl named Bryony who has a wild imagination. One day she sees her older sister, Cecily, and a boy, Robbie, having a water fight in the garden. But Bryony doesn't quite understand what's going on because she's too busy pretending she's a detective spying on them with her toy magnifying glass. So Bryony jumps to the wildest conclusion ever and thinks she witnessed a crime instead of a playful water battle. She runs around the house telling everyone that there's been a garden crime and that Robbie is a water bandit on the loose. Chaos ensues as everyone tries to figure out what's really going on. As Bryony grows up, she realizes her mistake and decides to become a detective for real to solve the mystery of the misunderstood water fight. It turns out laughter and forgiveness are the keys to solving this hilarious case of mistaken identity.
Oh my God.
That was really good. I have a really, really short one. Kind of a log line, but don't lie or you'll get people killed. Da-da-da-da-da.
I'm sure that was the elevator pitch.
Yeah.
This is a crazy movie.
Yeah, this is
water
the
fight.
The garden water fight. Is that what it was?
The garden water fight. It's just here's
part of the trailer from Atonement.
Beautiful day.
Are you enjoying your book?
No, not really. Fair fielding any day. Much more passionate.
Can I tell you something? Something really terrible.
Bryony read it.
It was a mistake. It was never meant to be read.
No.
What's Cecilia going to do?
I don't know. It's been there for weeks. You do know what I'm talking about, don't you? You knew before I did.
Why are you crying?
Cecilia! You ought to call the police.
You saw him?
Yes, I saw him.
Bryony!
I know it was him.
You know it was him? Or you saw him?
Yes, I saw him. I saw him with my own eyes.
I wouldn't believe everything Bryony tells you.
This movie's right. So good.
All right. So, yeah.
That's one of the better trailers that we've listened to. I get the vibe.
It is a good trailer, yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Let's talk a little bit about the movie facts here. And I mean, there is so much we could dive into on this, but I want some of this to come up in our discussion. But I think B, you have some facts for us. Do you want to possibly share?
Yeah, okay. For sure. We can go a little bit into the production. So like you said, Joe Wright directed this, came out in 2007, and it is adapted from the Ian McEwan novel by Christopher Hampton. Joe Wright brought his crew back together. He sort of famously likes to work with the same people, says it makes him feel safe. So Paul Tothill is back editing. For cinematography, we have Seamus McGarvey. Music by Dario Marianelli, who's had a great career after this, too. That guy is just, I love listening to his movies. I really want to talk about the costumes in this. Jacqueline Moran, who also has a great career post this movie, Barbie, Little Women. So she's working with, of course, you mentioned a little bit, starring Keira Knightley and James McAvoy as the troubled couple, Cecilia Tallis and Robbie Turner, Saoirse Ronan as Bryony, a young Bryony, Benedict Cumberbatch, early on for him, playing Paul Marshall, and Juno Temple, who I did not even recognize as Lola. Of course, now we all know her from Ted Lasso, and she's amazing.
And small appearance from Alfie Allen. You know, if everyone knows who that is, he's Theon Greyjoy from Game of Thrones. He's the handyman early on. I immediately recognized him in that. He's very young and looking innocent in this.
Also, a shout out to the score, which sounds like this. Diddly, 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 diddly.
Yeah. Listeners, that was actual footage of the Dario Marinelli.
Yeah, I just played the score. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Score is incredible because I mean, I'll make the note right now because I love any time that you have like the diegetic sound from a movie somehow
that.
Morphs its way into the score. It happens throughout this movie, and it's beautiful how it's done. We have to mention also that the score is the one, and this was nominated for 7 Academy Awards. It is the one thing it did win. At the 2008 Oscars, and deservingly so, I think.
Yeah, but if anyone's going to have great sound in a movie, it's Joe Wright.
Yeah.
I think you turn on one of his movies sometimes to listen to it as much to look at it.
Mm-hmm. Did we mention the budget? $30 million. And the domestic box office was $51 million, which is nothing fantastic, but it was $129 million box office for the global take.
Yep.
And it came out December, I think it was December 7th, 2007. We talked about this before we went on the air, but it was a long, kind of slow release. It did eventually go wide, and it stayed in theaters through April. So it was a slow
build. It opened to 30 theaters, you know, so it's really, it wasn't much.
And I think you have to point out that this came out in one of the biggest box office winters in recent memory.
Yeah.
We had There Will Be Blood coming out around then. We had No Country for Old Men. It was a packed winter at the box office. So I'm kind of not surprised that it took a different strategy because I think it would have drowned if it kind of went global, went big right away. Came out on the same day as The Golden Compass, which I think did not do well.
One of those movies has survived in our hearts and minds.
Released a week before when this came out was Awake, starring Hayden Christensen and Jessica Alba. I don't remember that movie at all. But released 1 week after this was also I Am Legend and Alvin and the Chipmunks, which was also – both those were pretty big. So just to give us all some context of where this was in the box office.
Yeah, and currently sitting in the box office is Enchanted, Beowulf, and, you know, some big ones. Fred Claus.
It was. I just want to talk about the Oscars for a moment. Like the 7 nominations, we talked about original score, which it won. It was nominated for Best Picture. That No Country for Old Men won that. Was also nominated for Juno, Michael Clayton, There Will Be Blood, Best Supporting Actress, Saoirse Ronan, but Tilda Swinton won that, I believe, for Michael Clayton. Best Adapted Screenplay, it was nominated for. No Country for Old Men won it that year. Best Art Direction, Sweeney Todd won it that year. And Best Cinematography, There Will Be Blood took it. What was the
costume?
Best Costume Design, but was nominated for. But Elizabeth the Golden Age won it that year.
Fine.
Yeah.
Fine.
You know, I was looking at all the 2008 awards. I've watched the Oscars, I think, every year for the last 30 years. I remember Braveheart was the first year I really got into the Oscars. That was one of the first years I remember.
For Scotland.
But I remember this year was so huge. I remember everyone was talking about There Will Be Blood and No Country. Juno was big that year. But it was such a great year because there was so much diversity. And there wasn't, even though There Will Be Blood was kind of like the talk of the town and No Country, there was a lot of parody. Every movie kind of got their moment that year. There isn't one film that took home 10 awards or anything like that. If you look at the big acting categories and even technical categories, it was spread around everywhere. So as every movie kind of got their moment.
They were all part of the cultural zeitgeist. They all had an impression, you know, like I drink your milkshake, you know, that kind of thing. I mean, all that stuff, like the movie made an impression in the general public.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's absolutely. One of the first Oscars I remember really following closely. And I remember people coming down to There Will Be Blood and No Country. And that being the Barbenheimer 2007, I think.
Yep. It also, and we won't get deep into this, but this did win Best Film at the BAFTAs and Best Production Design, and Golden Globe also won Best Drama for Motion Picture and Original Score as well at the Golden Globe. So it did pretty well overall. But I think we'll get into other details as we go along, but let's get into what we think of this film. And we drew straws before we began, and I got the short straw, so I will begin. Okay, so this movie, I think, is quite an enigma for me. Mm. I thoroughly enjoy it, but I'm also unsure if it's truly a great film.
Well, that's crazy.
What I have enjoyed over the past week is diving into the rabbit hole and unearthing the meaning behind all things this movie. It's been an extraordinary treasure hunt. I probably have done more research on this film than any movie that we've reviewed since doing this podcast. And it's because I really do like this movie, but I'm fascinated by the framing of how the story is told. I did originally see this in the summer of 2008, and I can't put my finger on it, but even back then I remember thoroughly enjoying this back then. That was 15 years ago now, which is crazy, but I think it never left my consciousness. And I think it's just because so many of the images from this movie have just been stuck in my brain for so long, 'cause they're so vivid. The green dress that Keira Knightley wears, the scene by the fountain, the evacuation of Dunkirk, the lasting image of Cecilia in the tunnel at the end of the film, without spoiling anything right now. But yeah. there are many, many more. It's almost like I had a dream of this film, yes. And all these visions were part of the story. I can't quite put my finger on it. I can't put it all together, but everything's so visceral in this film. And I love that about it, because it points to the fact that we're watching a film where the framework of it is through the retelling of a story by someone who is looking back, remembering things. And it's possibly not quite remembering things accurately. And that adds an aspect, a fascinating layer to the story that I'm really fascinated by. I think this movie is excellently crafted. The score and the sound mix, I think, go hand in hand for me. I love how the keystrokes of the typewriter morphed into Dario Marinelli's score. All the diegetic music in this is wonderful. Another example is at Dunkirk, where the chorus blends in perfectly with the soundtrack as well. That entire department is working in perfect tandem with this picture. I'm not all buttercups and roses with every part of this movie. I think there's a huge part of this that sort of bewilders me. And I think we'll be getting into that when we talk about the discussion of the plot. But for now, I'll leave it at that. My rating is a 4 for this, because I have some big questions I want us to talk about later about what this movie really means, what it's about. And I have a lot of questions about that. So I'm going to pass it on to Sam, because I want to hear what you have to say.
So I definitely hear your thoughts, and I agree with a lot of it. There's an adjective which, for me, really describes the way this movie is directed. The word is studied, and I have the definition here. Adjective, the word is studied, of a quality or result achieved or maintained by careful and deliberate effort. Here's the thing about this movie. I like it a lot. I totally agree, Nathan. The images burn into my mind. There's something dreamlike about it, where you kind of take the images in this movie and you run with it, and it kind of invades your own psyche in a good way. So it definitely leaves an impression. I think the reason why I like this movie but don't necessarily love it is because because it is so carefully and well constructed, I find myself a bit emotionally distant from it and from the character. There is a very efficient, painterly, slight coldness to the story, where I feel like I'm watching very well-crafted filmmaking and great acting and good blocking, but I feel the effort on the screen. It's certainly not laborious, but there's a kind of, I feel the work going into it. So I enjoy the movie, and I'm not saying that it has to be like, you know, an emotional wild ride where I laugh and I cry, but I more enjoy this movie in a painterly sense, but I don't feel much when I'm watching it. I admire the Rashomon storytelling
and the editing and the moving around, the going through space and time in a very unique way, and her looking back without going into the ending, I find that to be one of the most emotional parts because it's devastating and hits like a ton of bricks. I love the Dunkirk scene. I think the long shot in the Dunkirk scene, in some ways, I find the visuals of Dunkirk in this film more memorable than Dunkirk by Christopher Nolan. So, but the reason that I would give it a very, very, like, the most robust, like, 3.5 stars that I could, but I like it, but there's something about it, and it depends on the mood that I'm in, but there's something about it where I just find the movie to be a technical masterpiece, but I find myself wanting to be emotionally let in a bit more. And I feel like I'm watching a very well-crafted, painterly, slightly cold film. And so that's why I would give it 3.5 and not 4. I almost gave it a very robust 3, but it really deserves a little bit more of that because the visuals are so spectacular. I just feel a strange, a disconnect in some ways when I watch this film, where oddly enough, these two movies have nothing to do with each other. But last week when we watched Out of Africa, I feel a more of a warmth. I feel closer to the characters. The characters are three-dimensional and they're well thought out, but there's so much precision that the movie almost feels like an incredible corset where it's so tight. You're just like, can you just loosen up just a little bit? And a perfect example of that is the shot when we see grown up. Briony, there's a shot in the hospital and all the other nurses like,
hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group, no purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions, 18 plus.
Flow out of the shot.
Yes.
Centered perfectly in the frame, and it's so perfect and so like a museum piece that I don't want to breathe because I don't want to like ruffle anyone's like hair or in the movie. Like, you know, perfect example of the studiedness of this film, the opening shot, you have the miniature of the house, you pan across the floor, and the animals in a line across the rug are so perfectly set that I appreciate it and I like it, but I just feel this kind of meticulous effort where I feel the labor is on the screen in a little bit. So that's my overall rating. It is still a quality film. And this is a movie, you know, a positive rating. Definitely give it 3.5 stars. It really is filmmaking. It's one of those films you just really have to be in the mood for that type of film when you watch it, because there's a specificity to it that I feel like audiences either will glom onto or not. And there's a bit of a hit or miss for that for me. So that's my overall basic review.
Sam, do you think this movie would have benefited if Joe Wright allowed it to breathe more? I mean, it is a tight film. There is very little fat on this movie. It moves. There aren't that many scenes that I would say are extraneous, that are these characters just kind of breathing. And there are some deleted scenes on the DVD where they are walking and you're spending some time with them, but it's all deleted out of this. I feel like this is really pared down to the leanest version that you could have.
And I'm definitely all for the leanness. I don't think the leanness is an issue. I think the leanness is good. I'm saying that within the leanness, my reaction to the film is I feel an emotional distance where no matter what happens on the screen, it's hard for me to feel a lot because there's something about the direction that keeps me at a distance no matter what comes out on the screen. You know, there's a shot where they're walking, I think, like in the fields of France, and there's like a stream to the right of the soldiers, and you see the reflection of like planes go by, and it's so meticulous that I'm like, can I just see like a little bit of dust roll by the lens or something? It's so perfect that it's almost sometimes the movie feels like a wax museum to me. That's just my reaction to it.
I think that's a fair read, Sam. I think like that's a very Joe Wright theater kid diorama maker, you know, like Anna Karenina, Cyrano, Pride and Prejudice, those all have that like model making feel.
They do. Yeah. But I'm a huge fan when he worked with Saoirse Ronan again in, oh my God, Hannah? What was the movie? In Hannah. Hannah. Yeah. Hannah has that same, but Hannah, it gets a little bit more visceral.
I was wondering if it has something to do with the digital filmmaking. I mean, out of Africa, we're talking like, you know, celluloid.
And I was wondering if it had something to do with them being English, not even to be funny, but I mean, it's, you cut to scenes where there's very little dialogue, which could read as like, wow, there's a lot unspoken. That's very emotional, but it could also just very reserved people.
See, I've always loved what I call like stiff upper lip British characters, but there are plenty of those characters in other films, including a movie that we will be reviewing soon called The English Patient, which I find incredibly emotional. So for me, I just have connectivity issues where it's good. I think the scenes of war are great. There's a heavy darkness to the movie that I really like. And there's a kind of like grandeur to it, and there's an epicness to it. The score is amazing. I just find myself feeling disconnected. But the interesting thing is, I don't have a suggestion as to feeling more connected. I will say that I've been watching other movies this past week that I respond amazingly emotionally to that are not as good movies, that are technically not as high quality films as this, but there's some type of disconnect where I appreciate it a lot, but I just wish I felt like more immersed somehow. But that, I mean, I love the first half at the mansion, the stiff British upper lip. I love like Benedict Cumberbatch. He's really creepy. And like, the acting is great. And I love the dialogue too. I really think it's a more of a technical directing thing, more of Edgar Wright's style that gets to me a little bit, even though I think he's a brilliant director. It's just how I respond to the material.
Okay.
It's all totally fair. But don't worry, Sam. I feel this movie enough for both of us. I didn't remember how much I loved this movie. And this movie, like you, it's stamped into my brain. Every frame that came up, I went, yes, I remember that. But this movie just swims in my veins like a fish. Every time I watch it, it is just like watching a dream. My sort of weakness, my secret sauce that I love is when a movie is fungible with time and when it can do that in this really ethereal quality and the storytelling quality. I just think it's so powerful, this nonlinear storytelling. It just really works for me. I also think because of the nature of Cecilia and Robbie's relationship and the way it plays with time, you know, on this watch, I was watching it thinking like, it's about the loss of potential, right? There's so much potential for their romance. There's so much potential for what their lives could have been. It's this sliding doors moment, and it's not their fault. And so, you know, getting a little older and watching it now, I sort of see it as that and sort of the loss of a life that could have been not just a romance, that could have been an epic romance, but really just the way lives get cut short very early on, and how they shift and how they have to change and who's responsible for that and how that responsibility plays out years later. I just think that's an interesting theme of it that I hadn't necessarily picked up on outside of the romance before now. I think it weaves together the intricate plot lines. It's really James McAvoy's movie. I think he carries so much of it, and I think he does it really beautifully. I have a lot of great things to say about this movie, but it's that dreamlike quality that I think stays with me the most.
I hear that. It's like,
yeah,
to me, it feels like a film on the cusp of greatness. And that's why it just like it, I'm of two minds, but I hear 100% what you're saying. And I think that the time play is like to its benefit, you know?
Yeah. I like that time play.
I love the time play. And I think it's great. It's a great way to talk about just telling a story in general. I just think it's super interesting. I would give it a 4. I think it's a solid 4 for me. Yeah. So much of it works. The costumes really work for me. The acting really works for me. I think there's so many beautiful, just like really beautiful scenes in this movie. That last scene in the tunnel that you mentioned, Nathan. I think that's gorgeous. Yeah.
I love it too when she's like standing below the Seven Sister Cliffs, which are those rolling cliffs in England with the white chalk, which is where they imagine there. But yeah.
There's so much to talk about with this plot, but I want to kind of break down some of the major things here. Mm-hmm. First thing is a big chunk of this movie, like the whole entire first act, which is a big part of this, sort of takes place in one day. And this is kind of like the Rashomon part of the movie, which is, I think, my favorite part of this film.
Really?
It is, because I think the whole movie hangs on everything that happens in this day, which is all kind of seen from the perspective of the Saoirse Ronan character, Bryony, and all of everything that she is interpreting or misinterpreting from this and what results from that. I think there's a lot that is going on here to talk about. So the first thing is the fountain scene. I think it's worth mentioning because this was... First thing is, I love the fact that Bryony is a storyteller at a very young age, a playwright, and she's already writing a story in the very beginning. I think it's called The Trials of Arabella. And I think it's hysterical that right away she's trying to wrangle her cousins and be the director. You play this. And they're just kids. And they're like, oh, I'd rather go swimming instead. I feel I've been in those shoes before, trying to get people who have no interest in being in a play or being in a movie. And like, no.
Yeah.
We've all been there. I think all three of us trying to get people to be interested in our, please read our script. No, I'm not going to do it. You know? So I thought that was hysterical. But then she goes to look outside the window afterwards and she sees what looks like Robbie kind of ordering her sister to jump in the fountain. And she sort of disrobes, jumps in, which must be, I've never seen a fountain that's 10 feet deep, but she jumps in. And I love how this scene takes place. She jumps out like Aphrodite, you know? I love the way this is shot. And I mean, that's actually later in the movie where I think you see his perspective of what really happens.
You see Joe Wright's hand fetish.
I love the way the story is told, where first we see Bryony's perspective of this, and then without even saying it up that this is like an hour earlier or whatever it is, you know, Keira Knightley's character is walking around this mansion, and then her and Robbie start talking, and we see, oh, this is the scene that leads up to this, you know, from what we saw earlier, and we see what really happened. It was much more of a playful, flirtatious moment instead. Mm-hmm. So the audience is already being led on to what really happened here. And it's a really great moment in a fun scene. What was I going
to
say?
Yeah. It immediately lets us on to Bryony as the unreliable narrator.
Yes.
Right? We already get to see her misinterpret a scene as just like a young kid who just doesn't know that much.
There's another scene that I really like, and I think it's easy to miss this. I have a note here. Let me just give me a second. It's this really, really gorgeous scene that takes place with Cecilia and Robbie, where she's getting ready for the evening. Mm-hmm. And Robbie is typing a letter, and it's edited in this way that it's almost like they're communicating, but they're they're in completely different locations. But many of the shots, we see them in reflection, and I just love the music. We hear this Italian opera. I think it's La Boheme. I had to like use my
La Boheme.
Like, yeah, La Boheme. Is that what it is? Oh, apologies. I had to use my app to find out what this was, because I really love the mood that this sets for this. It's just a great piece of music that sets the scene. It's such an intimate scene. And this was one of the parts of the film that I remember from like 15 years ago that I saw this that just stuck in my brain. Mm-hmm. And I remember nothing about it, but I just remember this communication that they're having in this moment. But you know that she is thinking about him, and he's writing this letter. I just love the way that this is all shot. Mm-hmm. It's really gorgeous. I don't know if this is something that struck you guys.
For sure. And I also think it's at a point, because we've seen Benedict Cumberbatch's character interact with Lola at this point, right? We've seen him interact with the kids. And so I think it's interesting that this movie is like already setting you up with all the kinds of romances and adult relationships that people have, right? Mother has migraines. She's in bed. Mm-hmm. We don't see father for a while. Benedict's a creep. He's awful with Lola. You know, we have Bryony's interpretation of an adult relationship, which is probably colored by all these things happening around her. And then we have this love of people who are not together right at the beginning.
Benedict Cumberbatch has two of my favorite lines in this movie, though. And one of them is obvious.
Oh, boy.
But the creepiest lines. Obviously, one of them is when he is he's flirting with Lola, who I think is 14 or 15 years old, played by Juno Temple. And it's so creepy. It's not just the way that he's talking to her. It's shot so well. They're playing this weird hide and seek with those two pillars where they're kind of like hiding behind. It's done so well.
And you just have this poor, precocious kid.
Yeah. But they're kind of teasing, playing, and hiding behind these things. Did you notice the ASMR Foley that's coming there? She's unwrapping this. That wrapper gets so loud as she's unwrapping that. And this is supposed to be the sensual unwrapping of the chocolate. And he says, you have to bite it. Yeah. And I'm telling you, I paused the movie. I had to walk away. I did a lap around the house. Taking a break. Yeah. That is the break. I can't imagine seeing this in the theater, because I would have had to projection.
Sit and squab
the film for a moment. I need to get a drink or something. But he also earlier says something that I just laughed out loud saying. And he says, while they're at the lake or the pond, his name is Paul Marshall. He has this line: I make a cocktail with crushed ice, rum, and melted dark chocolate. It's absolutely scrumptious. And that was the first indication that this guy's he's a piece of shit and incorrigible. But I just laughed so hard the way he said that.
When he says that, and like, I think Keira Knightley like dives off the diving board. That scene to me was the most alive scene of that entire first hour. That was the one where I actually felt less tedium for a moment. And I was like, oh, okay, let's go with this.
I think there's so much amazing buildup happening in that first hour of the movie. It is so juicy. There's so much melodrama happening in that first hour. It's like, I'm like, you know.
I prefer the second hour when the canvas gets grander and there's like tragedy to the romance, because the first hour is very
Final third is the final third is my favorite for sure. But I mean,
me
I
too.
Love this whole movie. We are introduced, and Nathan, we wanted to talk about this. We are introduced to like possibly water as a theme throughout this movie very early on. And I know Joe Wright insists he didn't clock that. That just wasn't a theme for him.
It doesn't make sense. There's the water.
It proliferates every scene. I mean, what does it mean?
The scene twice jumps willingly into water, which, you know, and there's a flashback scene where Robbie jumps in the water to save Bryony, but she just wanted to be saved by her. I mean, that's that, and that's it's also interesting timing for that scene. I kind of wonder, I kind of question also, why does that scene take place when it does? I'm trying to place it in the movie. Is that, that's set before Dunkirk?
I think it's when Bryony's a teen or like a
nurse. it's after she's 18-year-old and it's a flashback to when she's 13 or 12 again.
But we see her, I think it's because we see her writing, right?
Mm-hmm.
You mean when she falls into the water and McAvoy saves her?
Yeah, when she's intentional.
So that scene, I think, really sets us up for Bryony's intention for this whole miscommunication. And I think
it shows that she has this crush on him.
Right. But, I think it brings about this, sort of, well, did she accuse McAvoy because she was jealous of her sister and she saw them in the library and she had this big crush on him? Did she do it? Just was it really a case of mistaken identity? I think it opens up a lot of different motivators for Bryony as a young kid.
I think it maybe it reinforces it for the audience. I felt like I already knew that, though.
Okay.
I don't know.
When she jumps into that river on purpose, the water does not seem particularly dangerous to me at all.
I agree.
I kind of wonder, it wasn't a dangerous situation. And his reaction to her jumping in was very over the top, which I think is something I want to bring up later as well. But he gets very angry about it. But the theme of water also, I mean, there's so much water symbolism in this movie as well. I mean, I did a lot of research on this, but this whole water thing. I mean, water in general, we need water to clean everything. And I think that's right. A big part is water. We need water to live. In this film, the characters utilize water as a symbolic means to cleanse or rid themselves of emotions they're seeking to suppress or express. Cecilia, plunges into water during this conversation, with her brother, who questions her reluctance when she wants when they're trying to invite Robbie to dinner. And then she's jumping in. It's almost like submerging her emotions. Robbie's taking a bath and, which is implying he's contemplating his feelings about Cecilia, at that time. Mm-hmm. And then we're talking about this flashback, and Robbie had previously saved Bryony from drowning here. And that act is unburdening, Bryony emotionally, that she, so that she can share her feelings, about Robbie in a way. And in the end, and I think we're in spoilers at this point, Cecilia dies in the Blitz when the tunnel is flooded and she drowns. And finally, and I think we can even jump to the end here, Cecilia and Robbie can finally express their feelings, in the end. We see them frolicking joyfully in the ocean, and they right there throughout the story, all these societal class, distinctions, imprisonment, all the specter of war, and all these constraints that time has been hindering, them and their ability to communicate their emotions. Water has been the vessel that allows them to express those feelings without inhibitions. So, I mean, how can Joel Wright say that water is not, it's just an arbitrary thing in this? I mean, this whole movie is about water.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
This is where projects come to life. Our showrooms are designed to inspire with the latest products from top brands, curated in an inviting, hands-on environment, and a team of industry experts to support your project. We'll be there to make sure everything goes as planned, from product selection to delivery coordination. At Ferguson Bath, Kitchen, and Lighting Gallery, your project is our priority.
Schedule your showroom consultation and see more from brands like Jennair at build.com/Ferguson.
unbridling those emotions every time that water is involved in this. It is cleansing themselves.
But that's the great thing about films, because even though he didn't probably intend that with the water, it's totally fine for an audience member to like interpret it that way, you know?
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
It's open to interpretation.
Yeah. I think water's absolutely a vector here for their emotional depth. I also thought of water a lot. There's a lot of religious imagery here. And I thought a lot about baptism and cleansing and starting over. And, you know, like if you think about it, it's Bryony telling the story. She's the one writing all the water imagery. And
she's the one, because when she gives them those moments at the end, it's because she feels guilt. But they never have those moments in real life. They die separately. That's the reality of it. And it's the fantasy of the person that screwed them over feeling really guilty about it. So it's just,
well, technically this whole thing could be fantasy, right? I mean, like to an extent. So I think like it's also the depth of Bryony's emotions. And I think it's about her, like her cleansing and coming clean, her big coming clean. I thought about that a lot because it's her story.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
I love it.
And there's, you know, let's, what else can we talk about here? Oh, the other thing was, let's talk about Dunkirk. I think, you know, we can talk about that. I think that's something worth
another mentioning. Water scene.
It is another water scene because, you know, they're there also looking for water as well, and they can't, which ultimately results in Robbie's demise.
He had sepsis, but
but he dies later that night, and
that long shot is so beautifully done. I love it so much. It reminded me a little bit of a movie I don't like, actually. I like this much more, but it kind of reminded me of Paths of Glory, the end of Paths of Glory.
Don't like Paths of Glory? You're not a Kubrick fan.
We'll move on.
Not a Kubrick fan here, people.
Sorry. But you it kind of
send your hate mail to what's your email?
speaking of emotion, I feel tons more emotion with some Kubrick films. And it's crazy just throwing that out there, but yeah.
I don't associate emotion in Kubrick. I'm not coming to his defense on that, but
it just reminded me of the end when all the soldiers gather and they're listening to the singer who ended up becoming Kubrick's first wife. And they have that emotional outburst from hearing her sing, right? Like they're moved to tears from hearing her sing. And I thought about that with the chorus a little bit.
The chorus, when the camera pans around the chorus in the Dunkirk scene and they're singing that hymn, that's the most emotional scene in the whole film for me. That moment, because it's like they're holding it together in like a very, very dark chapter of that war. And they're there and they're like singing. So that's like beautiful. The quick Stanley Kubrick, Barry Lyndon comment, though, when his son dies in that film, I feel an enormous amount of emotion. So I would argue against that there's no emotion in Kubrick films. But
I cried when Hal died.
I know that was being sarcastic. And I'm being genuine, but I'm used to getting laughed at on this podcast. It's the way it is.
No. I do think Barry Lyndon, though, that's a fun tie-in, like with the colors and the costume and the dreaminess.
Little
haze over that movie.
Yeah.
How about?
I want to say one other thing about the evacuation of Dunkirk. I love that scene. I studied that when I was producing a oneer for a feature film. I did a whole feature film that was a single take, and I was trying to get my hands on any footage I can of how to do a single take, a long single take. And I did all the research I could on how Joel Wright did this and other long single takes. So this was a big inspiration for a feature that I did.
What did you think of the oneer in Babylon? I loved it.
Wait, now I'm blanking on that.
The Margot Robbie when she was dancing in the beginning.
Was it a fake single take?
The whole thing isn't one, but there's a section of it that's a one.
You know, I've only seen Babylon once and I really loved it, but I don't remember thinking that it was authentic single take. And that might be why it didn't really jump. I remember didn't the whole opening scene. I recommended the whole opening scene at some point, but because it just all blurs together as this giant, giant fever dream. So it all kind of blurs together.
That long shot in Atonement is so impressive because they take a really small strip of beach and make it feel like it's this big, you know, gigantic place. And it's just lensing and framing and, you know, but that boat and the carousel and those actors, they're all so close together. You know what I mean? If you were actually standing on that beach, it would seem a lot more diminished than it is in the lensing.
Oh, that's what I was going to say. I wanted to share a couple of facts about that. So it was done in one day, obviously, but it was three takes they got done, and they used the third one for the movie. They did try to do a fourth take of it, but the Steadicam operator collapsed.
Oh my God.
There were 300,000 soldiers on the beach that day, and they had 1,000 extras that were there to represent 300,000 soldiers. So they constantly were rotating extras all around. So when they would leave the screen, you would see the same extras used over and over again to kind of give the feeling that there were more people in the scene than there actually were.
Magic of the movies.
The Steadicam operator at times was on foot, but sometimes on the back of a golf cart, and you can actually see the tire tracks in the sand sometimes if you look close. It was done out of necessity to save time, says director Joe Wright. It was not the first idea that they had. They were always going to do a Dunkirk scene, but it was going to be done in a way that would have been a 3 or 4 day shoot, but this actually saved them time doing it this way. I don't know. It probably is the most memorable part of this movie. When people talk about Atonement, it's the movie with the long single take on the beach.
And the green dress.
Yeah. And now in a post Christopher Nolan Dunkirk world, people say it's the single take on the beach still. They don't know that it's Dunkirk. Actually, I don't know. I think when I saw Atonement, I don't even know if Dunkirk is really mentioned much in this movie, or it's really buried in there somewhere. It's not until I really did some research on this where I realized, maybe it was after I saw Dunkirk, where I realized, Atonement, that's Dunkirk. Yeah. And it's not really obvious, I think.
I definitely didn't get it when I first saw it.
No.
For sure.
So yeah, it's interesting. But I do have one thing I want to say about the Dunkirk scene. As beautiful as it is, as gorgeous as it is, and what a technical achievement as it is, it's 5 minutes long. Is it necessary? I mean, it's great because of the technical achievement, but it's 5 minutes. Does it push our story forward?
Yeah.
How?
Well, that's...
I don't think it pushes the story forward, but it's so spectacular and well done that it creates the most immersive moment in the movie. So you sort of, it's the one time where you actually feel like you're there. So it could have been easily achieved with a couple of shots, and it doesn't really change the narrative in any way. I just think it makes it more of a sensory experience because you're there and you're in it. And for once, you actually get to feel something in this movie.
I'm just playing devil's advocate for a moment here because I keep reading every once in a while complaints about it. It's just Joe Wright being overindulgent in this.
Lots of reviews said the exact same thing. They said, you know, we know what the director is doing. We're supposed to feel sad when the horses get shot. We're aware of it. It's still pretty cool. That was the kind of, you know,
like it draws attention to itself, things.
Yeah.
And it does have me thinking, I mean, I love watching this, but I do understand the other perspective of this. I mean, we are indulging in this for 5 minutes when I don't know if it's really necessary. I'm not saying that opinion is wrong, but I do get that point. And it could have easily been shot in a way where we had 45 seconds of this and we're out. But at the same time, we would not have had this amazing 5-minute oneer that I think will be remembered for the rest of cinema history. And,
I disagree.
You know?
Yeah. I think you need to have that. Well, I was trying to say earlier, I think you need to have that shot. I think it does move the movie forward. I think, first of all, we don't get to see a lot of the war, but we do get to see like physical changes in James McAvoy. And so I think it explains his character's dwindling, right? We get to see him really break down. We see him meet Cecilia and that exchange, which I want to talk about, when she's a nurse and they meet up at some kind of luncheon or cafeteria. And he is already a little more hollow. He's already a little more different.
Yeah.
But we really like he's broken by the time he gets to Dunkirk. And then they're both kind of robbed of real death scenes. It's mentioned, you know, in passing by Bryony during an interview, but we don't see them really die for long. So this being where James McAvoy dies later in the film sets us up to see what he went through. If yeah. this movie was told in a linear fashion, we would that would just be one scene, right? We would see everything he went through, what he was seeing, and then him passing away. So I think it works.
Okay. Well, is there anything else we want to talk about before we get to the final act of this movie?
I want to talk about that scene in the cafeteria.
All right, cafeteria, yes.
Yeah. I think it's such a great awkward exchange. I don't know how you two feel about it, but I think it's one of the best awkward exchanges I've seen on screen. There's so much that's not said. I was thinking about the script and how it just must look on paper. There's got to be so much white space on this script because they're just like, yes, I know. Me too. Don't think about it. It's just this sort of mutual understanding and acknowledgement that maybe a door has closed or maybe it's only a little open. There's some hope for the future, but it's so quick and so brief. And you get that wonderful moment from James when Kira says she has to go in a half an hour and he's just torn up about it. I think you really get to see the adults that they become in that scene.
I agree. I think that scene is great. It's all about what's not said
in
that cafeteria. And there's so much they want to say, but they don't know how. I think it's the best performance from either of them in the whole movie is that interaction.
It's the most they have to work with for sure.
Yeah.
You know, in terms of feeling. But yeah, I think it's super interesting. And then you get to see Bryony taking up little sister's shoes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Becoming a nurse. So her whole redemption quest is just like so strange to me. I don't know. How do you guys feel about it?
Her redemption is, I really question the authenticity of, because I think it's in that, and this is where I kind of have a sort of a problem with this movie. I would give this movie A pluses across the board if I could only kind of figure out what the movie's trying to say about Bryony's redemption. Are we supposed to feel bad for her? Are we supposed to forgive her? And this is what I don't know. I guess saying that the only way that she can atone for this is through story. It's her way out. But the story that she's weaved, she's created this happy ending. It gives us hope.
No line in cinema makes me angrier than I gave them their happiness.
But this is what the movie is telling us. You know, the film is asking us to forgive Bryony.
Yeah,
is that what the movie is?
I don't think so. I think it's presenting it as a form of atonement, but I think they make a point to show over and over again how like ineffective it is.
Do we need to mention that what we're talking about here is we've fast forwarded to present day or like at some point, and we have all of a sudden Vanessa Redgrave being interviewed.
Baller. Love that. I mean, that whole interview I want to talk about too, but even just her as a nurse, that scene of Bryony like scrubbing her hands, like really scrubbing them.
Water again, scrubbing away her sins.
Yeah, it totally gets me. And then she, you know, she's forming this like very quick friendship or relationship with this patient of hers, and she's crossing boundaries for it.
Wow, I love that.
I love it too, but I
want to talk about that for a second too.
Yeah, let's talk about it. We're here. Let's talk.
I think we're meant to empathize with her, but I'd not necessarily forgive her. You know what I mean? Because it is unforgivable. But people do make
bad mistakes, so you can feel something, but I don't think the film analyzes it one way or the other. It sort of presents the situation.
I agree. But let's talk about the patient, and then I want to talk about Lola.
I just love the setup of this. She is told by her supervisor that there's a French soldier that she needs to go hold his hand. And I'm assuming that he's dying. I love the staging of this. She it's almost staged like a play or on a stage. She walks over the whole camera, the whole thing just trucks over to the right, and she goes behind this red curtain. Red is not much of a color theme in this movie, but all of a sudden we have this red curtain. Remember, Brian is her own director, and it's almost like she opens the red curtain to the stage.
I read there's no red in the first half of this film.
Well, I believe it. And now, if you say that, I totally believe that. But the curtain opens to her audience, and then she is talking to this French soldier. It was funny. I think in the director's commentary, Joel Wright was saying that he doesn't speak or understand a lick of French, and he has no idea what they were saying at all. He could have been reading the recipe, which I got a chuckle out of. But I really appreciated the staging of that.
Yeah.
That scene really did move me a lot. I don't really know what it means necessarily. She's seeing the war up front. She's seeing French soldiers dying. I think it's just kind of all building to her mounting her guilt, I guess. But maybe there's another reading that I'm missing here, a deeper meaning to it.
Yeah. I think it imbues her with a little humanity. I also want to get a read on it because I think, you know, I was watching that in sort of a more cynical point of view towards Bryony. And I just think it's her grasping at the end, at the wrong moments to try and make things right, to try and mend a relationship, to try and be the one that fixes it, to be the one you love. Like, just to me, I watched that and I was like, she just still, there's so much about Bryony that hasn't grown up. You know, she keeps her same haircut. She keeps all that childlike stuff. She's still writing. She still does all the stuff. And I just think she never really figures out how to be good or do good at the beginning of something, you know.
She's essentially like mentally,
stunted.
Yeah, definitely. Which is dangerous. I mean, look what she did to them, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, maybe she should have been locked up. I'm just saying.
she is messed up. Yeah.
Well, how do you think, we get to see Lola's wedding to Paul Marshall from her perspective at this time in her life?
I'm also wondering, is that the trigger for her when she sees the newsreel and sees Paul Marshall marries Lola? And I love how Lola turns and looks right at Bryony in that newsreel. The eye lines match up perfect, and oh my god, looks right at her. That was a wonderful moment,
and just, her smashing just, bride Bryony.
It just gave me the willies when I saw that. I forgot all about that in because I haven't seen this movie in so long, but what a great moment. Anything goes to the wedding.
Goes to the wedding, and then they dart and avoid each other's eyes.
Yeah,
you know, and you have to wonder, there's another story there for Lola. Another story
not told. Yeah, but again, all these little things are mounting within inside of Bryony, her guilt to seek that atonement, I guess. So we got to the end, then we backed up a little bit, and I think we needed that set up a little bit. So I think it's right after that is when we do get to present day, and all of a sudden we are with Vanessa Redgrave being interviewed. You know who she's being interviewed by?
Mm-mm.
Anthony Minghella.
Who's
director of the English Patient?
Exactly. Yeah. And he died actually shortly after this movie came out too, which is unfortunate. But I thought that was interesting. I was trying to find a connection with Anthony Minghella and maybe the English Patient or other movies that Anthony Minghella has done to Atonement. I thought that was an interesting choice.
We were destined.
What a perfect transition to the English Patient next week. But I just thought that was an interesting choice for an interviewer.
Yeah.
I don't know if they're just good friends.
Maybe they're friends. Yeah.
Must be. Anyways, mm-hmm. but Vanessa Redgrave is retelling her story, or the story, or well, her book. She mentions that she's written 21 books, but this book is going to be her last.
Mm-hmm. Because she's old.
She's just old. No, she's dying. I forget what she actually has, but basically she is
having lots of little strokes.
Lots of little strokes, and she's losing her memory also. It was will be part of this, which I thought was an interesting thing to make note of. Mm-hmm. In this, I keep knocking my microphone. Not good.
It's okay, we got you, Chief. Yeah. This is interesting because it also looks so different than the rest of the movie, this part where she's being interviewed. It's so much more stark. But I was watching it and it just hits me. Like, this is the part of the movie where I'm just openly weeping. Just so sad to me. I mean,
this is where projects come to life. Our showrooms are designed to inspire with the latest products from top brands, curated in an inviting, hands-on environment and a team of industry experts to support your project. We'll be there to make sure everything goes as planned, from product selection to delivery coordination. At Ferguson Bath, Kitchen and Lighting Gallery, your project is our priority.
Schedule your showroom consultation and see more from brands like Jen Air at build.com/Ferguson.
Are you struggling to lose weight and keep it off? Tired of wasting time and money on starvation diets that lead to more frustration and stress? If there was a weight loss solution that could actually work for you, would you try it? Then head to golo.com.
I'm Steve. I lost 138 pounds in 9 months on Golo.
I'm Amber. I've lost 128 pounds with Golo taking release.
If you're ready to take back control of your life, head to golo.com now and see how Golo can work for you. That's golo.com.
My sleep is way better. My inflammation has gone way down. Golo saved my life. I was way overweight. That's what sent me down the path. I wanted to make sure and live for my kid.
I have literally tried everything. I was on the verge of getting gastric bypass surgery, and I saw the Golo commercial, and it was the last thing I tried because it worked.
Join over 2 million people who have found a better way to lose weight with Golo. Your healthier and happier life begins at golo.com. That's golo.com. Again, golo.com.
We've gotten to the point where she recognizes the weight of what she's done, but then she delivers the gut punch where what she told you, that final scene with Cecilia and Robbie is fiction.
Oh, we forgot something. We need to talk about the encounter where she does seek the atonement, where she visits her sister. We glossed right over that. I know.
I think that's important
because we're talking about this. She, after she goes to the wedding, she does go to her sister's apartment where she seeks forgiveness from Cecilia, and Robbie is there. They're together. Mm-hmm. And it appears that their lives are good. That he's back from the war. They're in love. Mm-hmm. Things are fine. This is in her, what, the happy ending in a lot of ways that we, wait a minute, when did this happen? He's all better. It just kind of glosses through his sepsis and everything's fine again. So, but some interesting things happen in this scene here. Robbie comes out and confronts Briarty and gets very, very angry with her. They have a pretty big fight about this. In retrospect, I think after finishing the movie, you look back at the scene and we find out afterwards that this scene never happened.
Right.
Because we learn afterwards that both these characters, Cecilia and Robbie, died, you know, in the war. And you look back at this and you kind of find the moments in this that really are inauthentic, that were made up. And I don't know if you look back at this and see anything that doesn't make sense. And I've been thinking about this all week. You know, would Robbie be so angry after all these years still? I mean, perhaps. You know, Briarty is punishing herself in this moment. This is what she felt she had to do. Robbie is angry in a way that we've never really seen him, except for the one time in the flashback when Briarty experiences his wrath when she when she had Robbie save him from being drowned. I think it's the one time he had that kind of anger and wrath.
That
kind of matches the level in both scenes. So I think she's able to kind of write about it in the book. And that might be why we see that scene, why he acts that way. Mm-hmm. So I think if you look at that scene in retrospect, you kind of see how it is an authentic moment.
I think with Cecilia's come back to me too, right? That seems like it's just the sort of like unnatural affectation, something a movie couple would do, right?
Yeah. And then when she leaves and there, you see them like making out on the second floor. It's so Hollywood. It's so like, this is a storybook type thing.
Right. But you know? she does bring up, you know, I think it was during, you know, the Lola Paul Marshall newsreel that it sunk in. I think she always knew it might not have been Robbie. I think there was always doubts about that. But I think it sunk in who it was, because Cecilia in her fantasy is like, well, if you really, it gives her a way to do right. Right. Cecilia says, well, you can go back and report what you know about Danny Hardman, who is the other person. And Bryony's like, it was actually Paul. And it's too late. Now they're married. They can't testify against each other. So even in her fantasy of atonement, she tries to atone. She gets in trouble for trying to atone. And they give her another way to do it. And she can't. So she's just like, oh, it's there's nothing I can do. Right. I've tried everything.
Yeah.
I'm a perpetual victim, Bryony.
So
I'd really like to read the book by Ian McKellen. I would just be fascinated.
Yeah. Oh, it's got to be a good book, right?
I feel like the book can just delve into all the psychological aspects so well. You can just go into people's minds with writing, because you don't have to worry about like pacing in a novel, really. I mean, you do, but in a different way, sort of, yeah.
This is a book I wouldn't mind checking out as well. Yeah. Okay. We keep going back and forth. Not unlike this movie, but let's once again get to this. So we have Vanessa Redgrave. She's being interviewed. And this is where I'm having a little bit of difficult time with this. What is this film saying? You know, again, are we here to forgive Bryony?
I think it's just super sad.
I don't mean this in a negative way at all. I don't think it's commenting on it. I think it's just showing the aftermath and the weight and the regret that she feels. But I don't think it's siding or not siding with her. I think it just presents it and shows it emotionally. I actually find that scene really grounded, because it seems like you're watching an almost more modern day interview where the style kind of lets loose a little bit, and you're just seeing someone who has so much regret in their soul. It's like a spectacular epitaph, you know, but I don't think there's a meaning or a, should we forgive her? Should we not forgive her? I think she's a flawed human being that made a mistake, and her punishment is not, you know, some type of like jail time or prison sentence. Her punishment is living with it. And I think it's just showing that her atonement is writing about it and working through those emotions that she had to unpack over so many years. So I think it's just kind of more of a character arc than saying like, we forgive her or we do not forgive her. I think the movie purposely leaves it ambiguous to let the audience feel what they will feel. And I find the ending very emotional, especially when she explains that, you know, she, my God, what's, you know, not Brianna, but Cecilia. Cecilia died in the Blitzkrieg in the tunnels. And you see like the, you know, I think for me, what gives the movie the power is that it goes to the darkness and doesn't wrap it up in a nice bow. And it's like, oof, the repercussions of you know what it is? I think the theme of the movie is actions have consequence. I mean, I think it goes down to, you know, it's like, you know, you may not feel that powerful as a person, but you could affect the trajectory of someone's whole life by a single comment. You know what I mean? So it's sort of like, be careful. That's the message that I get from it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the only other thing I want to say again, because I just love how there's just this whole extra layer to this, because we've now learned that the Vanessa Redgrave version of Bryony you know, has admitted that she's dying. She has, her brain is going, which makes us know that we have now watched this whole movie, this retelling, through the perspective of an older person who is losing their memory. And knowing this, what can we believe to be true now? Mm-hmm. When so many times we are reminded that we are dealing with an unreliable narrator. She has lied to herself about the events of her childhood, to the authorities, and now she has embellished in her novel. And on top of that, she is losing her memory. The truth is lost on all of us. And all we have is her story. And which is kind of how I now absorb this movie and how I remember it when I first saw it in 2008, as kind of like vignettes. As this movie, mm-hmm. I think, will always kind of live with me as maybe not as a linear story, but just kind of a feeling when mm-hmm. I think of Atonement. And I think that may, and I don't know if that was intentional. Maybe it's more in the text, in the novelization of this, or it really originally was a novel. And I think that's what makes this movie special and why I like it. Because after I've stopped watching this, I keep going back to realizing that I don't even know if what I watched is real mm-hmm. in the context of the movie. Am I supposed to be? Am I overthinking this? But maybe that's the whole idea. Yeah. And I think it's kind of cool that I've been spending the last 4 days questioning if is anything here anything? Or is it all real? Or is, you know, or is it somewhere in the middle there?
I think the underlying feeling that the underlying feeling that the movie gives off is its most successful act, because no matter how what you think of it, you can't forget it. It's not a movie that you watch and you don't remember after you leave the theater or, you know, leave your living room. Like it, you'll always remember it. It does make an impression, that's for sure. Yeah.
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 I think it's beautiful. It's tragic, but I think it's beautiful.
Yeah. All right. I don't know if I have really anything else to say about it. I've gushed and said so much about this. I want to say one other thing about the green dress, because I made this note that I just really, really love. You already mentioned that Jacqueline Duran designed the green dress. There were many, many green dresses that were designed for this movie because they kept breaking. In my research, I read that the idea behind this, the color green, was to symbolize the internalization of feelings between Robbie and Cecilia, and also the jealousy of Bryony.
Oh, I love that.
I really loved that as well. Yeah.
I got kind of a Daisy Buchanan thing, the green light.
Oh, okay.
Great Gatsby.
And the other thing, other note, I have more notes on this than any other movie we've ever done. Where is it here? The library scene. This is really fascinating.
Yeah. We totally glossed over that scene.
I could talk for another hour about this movie, but I don't want to do that I don't actually want to do that. The library scene I had a really cool note on this. Let me do my find. Library. If I can spell library. All right. This is kind of deep. But when Cecilia and Robbie are having their only sexual encounter in the movie, in the library, and share that they are in love with each other, this parallels in the end of the movie, where their only happiness they will ever find is also in literature.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah.
Aww. Such a sad friggin' movie. So good.
Yeah. It's a deep rabbit hole in this, all this stuff. Yeah.
It's an excellent movie for analytical, intelligent people to jerk off to, you know?
Yeah. That's what I did the whole time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You're so smart. You found so many connections. I go to movies for more emotional experiences, but I appreciate the desire to analyze, because that's, you
know, I think I felt this movie emotionally, just the analytical stuff like beefs it up for me, but it's definitely an emotional experience. Yeah.
Okay.
For me.
Let's take a quick break.
We're all above 130 IQ here, so which is good. Yeah.
Let's take a quick break here.
Average person would just be like, yeah, they just like had sex in a library, you know, like, great.
What I really thought was cool when Bryony catches them, how they're kind of like caught, like they're spread out like insects, like in this weird way. Yeah. It's kind of like this, the way they're caught is like, that's just such crazy, interesting staging.
The meaning that I took there is they're actually, you know, with their arms, they're actually out flapping kind of like a bird. And they're meant to fly, but they're trapped by the literature of her writing. That's what that scene was all about. And, you know,
for putting it together for me, Sam. Thanks, Sam.
Anyone that doesn't notice that, you're really, really dumb and didn't get education. Yeah.
We didn't really even talk about Bryony as the god of her own domain here. I mean, she has the dollhouse, she has the Garden of Eden. There's so many biblical references here. We didn't even go down that path. And we're not going to, because we could probably do a part two of this episode, but let's not.
Next week, part two.
I just want to thank everyone for tuning into our show. Your feedback would be greatly appreciated. If you think we are just getting way too nerdy on atonement, let us know. Your opinions, whether you agree with us or disagree, are much appreciated. You can email us at backtotheframery@gmail.com. You can find us on Facebook, Instagram, Threads, TikTok. At Back to the Frame Rate. We also can be found on Twitter, or X. I guess it's just X now. I keep calling it Twitter. At Back Frame Rate. Sign up for our monthly newsletter, Frame Rate Monthly. And you can do that by emailing us at backtotheframerate@gmail.com. Help us spread the word. Tell your friends, family, colleagues, anyone. Leave us review. How about a review?
Leave us a Robbie style note, though.
No, please don't call us things that Robbie calls us.
Leave us a book written in English prose.
Please.
Write a review. Write a novel review about it.
Also, we have a poll out right now in our newsletter, or you can find it in the show notes. We want your feedback helping us shape our future. What type of content would you like us to do? You know, we could do more themes. We could do director retrospectives, actor retrospectives. Give us check out the poll and send in your feedback. We'd love to know what you think and what you'd like us to continue doing. All right, let's get to our MVP and if this movie is going to be going into our vault or not. I guess I'm first.
Dun, dun, dun.
All right. This might be other people's picks, but I'm going with the green dress because it's just so iconic. I'm also, I don't want to get canceled for this, but not just the green dress, but Keira Knightley's back also in the green dress as well.
Yeah.
They just kind of go hand in hand. It was great costuming. I think overall the costuming in this is fantastic. It did get a nomination, but it's so iconic, the dress. I don't even know what to say anymore about this movie. I need to shut up and just.
I think you like this movie more than you thought you did when you came into this episode.
Yeah, I probably did. Yeah. All right. Sam.
I'm going to be very stereotypical and say the Dunkirk long shot, just because I love that moment. And just the way it was shot when they go around, the camera revolves around the carousel. When they're singing that hymn, which I looked up the name, by the way, but forgot to write down, but it's a spectacular moment.
Great. Yeah.
For me, it's the final shot of them on the beach.
Yeah.
Gut punch.
It is a good gut punch, yeah. Which is the same thing as that postcard that we see that Robbie's carrying around.
Yeah.
Oh, this movie just has so many layers. Yeah.
I have several atonement postcards from the film. They like, I don't know where I got it, where so you can like mail.
Yeah, some promotional postcard.
Oh,
yeah.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, wow. Yeah.
That's great.
I have a piece of film negative from Memoria. Funny.
Woo!
All right. Well, does this movie go into the vault? I'll be honest. I could go either way. On this, I really do like this movie. And the reason why I'm going to say yes is because I have a feeling of all the movies that we are watching in this epic romance retrospective, I have a feeling it's going to be the only one that I'm going to say yes to. I there's somebody in this podcast that unfortunately is not here tonight, believes I have no love in my heart. It's not true. This isn't a stereotypical romance movie, but I do have a heart. And this movie did bring me to tears a couple times. So yes, I say yes, this is a very, very special and unique movie. It is not, I wouldn't say a great film or perfect film, but it is definitely special. So yes. All right, Sam.
I would say yes to The Vault as well, because it's such a visually memorable piece that I would definitely put it in The Vault. I could definitely understand it belonging there, though I respond more emotionally to films like Out of Africa and English Patient, which I think is a masterpiece. I appreciate this film, and occasionally I'm in the mood to watch a film like this. And when we're in the bunker mm-hmm. with the nuclear fallout, it would be nice to have it there if I felt like watching it.
Yeah.
Okay.
I was actually really torn on putting this in The Vault, because I feel like I put The Notebook in there, and I stand by that because it's a great movie and it's the blueprint. But then I was like, I don't know, if I put this one in, do I look like I just let anyone come into this vault? I don't know.
It's the open door policy.
Yeah, right. Yeah. So we come into this vault. But no, this guy go in The Vault. It's got to go in The Vault. It's too good not to go in The Vault.
Okay. And we will make it so.
Bam.
All right. Done.
Yeehaw.
Okay. We did it. We saved Atonement.
You're welcome.
You're welcome, world. Although it's only for us.
Well, for now.
For now. All right. Well, I think that's our show this week. And Back to the Frame Rate is part of the Westin Media Podcast Network. We wish to thank Brian Ellsworth for our show opening. On behalf of all of us, we bid you farewell from the fallout shelter. Your presence in our underground sanctuary is truly appreciated. We are truly sorry you cannot join us, but we want to express our gratitude for your company. If you're finding solace in our discussion, we kindly ask that you subscribe and leave a rating and review. Your support is the beacon of light that brightens our confined space. Head on over to Apple Podcasts or iTunes, Spotify, or whichever portal connects you to our broadcast, and share your thoughts. Until we emerge from the fallout, stay with us, keep hope alive, and keep those reviews coming. This is the end of our transmission. Back to the Frame Rate, signing off.
I want you to know it's over.
Well, bye.
This is where projects come to life. Our showrooms are designed to inspire with the latest products from top brands, curated in an inviting, hands-on environment, and a team of industry experts to support your project. We'll be there to make sure everything goes as planned, from product selection to delivery coordination. At Ferguson Bath, Kitchen, and Lighting Gallery, your project is our priority.
Schedule your showroom consultation and see more from brands like Jen Air at build.com/Ferguson.